We're going to get straight into our second session with Tim. So why don't we bow our heads and pray together as we begin. Father, once more, we thank you for the gospel of grace that unites us in Jesus Christ our Lord. We thank you for all that you've been teaching us this morning. And we thank you for Tim. And we ask, Lord, that he would be faithful to your word and helpful to us all in thinking through this great task of evangelizing the city and further afield. So please help him, strengthen him, empower him to help us. And we pray, Lord, that you would change us by your Spirit through your word today, that we might be the people you want us to be and bring glory to the name of Jesus. So strengthen him, we ask, and help us all to listen and understand and to change. And we ask it in the name and for the glory of Jesus. Amen.
Okay, I'm back. And are you back? I enjoyed that panel so much, and let me give you a reason to continue to come to these consultations this year or in the next few months. Every one of the networks it showed their differences. I just thought it was intriguing. Here's Richard Kochen in their tradition, you know, low church Anglicanism, the idea of setting goals, 1,000 churches. No, we don't do that. And then the New Frontiers, a prophetic goal of 1,000. So I mean, I'm a Presbyterian, you know, prophetic. Interesting. I it's very obvious that our networks have different strengths and weaknesses. It's very obvious that to some degree that's inevitable because no one network of churches or no one church or no denomination or tradition has all of the gospel renewal strengths in equal proportions. Remember, when we talked about the Delta effect, that's to some degree always inevitable. And when each network listed the challenges, and actually I could think of other challenges, and they could too, that they didn't get up there on the screen. There's no better way to get answers to your biggest questions than to talk about your issues not just inside your network, where it's very difficult to think outside of the box, your little box, because you all think alike. It's tremendous to work on some of these differences with brothers and sisters who also believe the gospel, just as passionate for the gospel, who are different and will remain different on a number of other secondary issues, but who will have insights and will probably give you ideas that you would never have thought about unless you were regularly meeting together to talk about these issues. There's almost no better way for you to answer the biggest questions of your network than to meet with these other networks and talk about these things. And there never has been an ongoing forum. There's been a lot of talk in London, in New York. There's lots of talk about we need to do more cooperation, we need to do more partnership. Well, a great first step for you would not be to just have one meeting in which, isn't it wonderful, all the different groups that were there, but to say, we're going to work on our problems together. We're going to try to get answers. And each network will maintain its integrity, but by talking together about these things, we're going to get insights about how we can be better. One of the things that's very easy for me as a Presbyterian in a place like New York City, surrounded by Pentecostals, has been to say, well, I'm not Pentecostal, but boy, those Pentecostals do some things that I know I should be doing as a Presbyterian better than I do. And you're inspired by the other networks to work on your own weaknesses, and you get ideas, very specific ideas that you see being carried out in these other traditions and networks that then you incorporate and you strengthen your own. If you've never had this before, and it looks to me like you haven't, at least not in many, many, many decades in a place like London, I would say please keep coming back. I won't be, for example, the speaker every time, and I know to some degree I'm a bit of a catalyst for this to happen, and I'm delighted, but I'm only one part of what I think God is cooking up here. I'm only one ingredient in this stew. And please come back. Please keep coming. And let's see what God does. Now, I'm moving from what I think most of us can, what we're able to agree with. What is gospel renewal? And notice that my first talk, I was laying out the first part of what I would call gospel DNA that all urban churches, if you're going to be part of a church planting movement that really reaches cities, this is the DNA. You have to be committed to this. And I went into gospel renewal. I did it in a way I hope that did not necessarily, it wasn't prejudiced in the direction of one tradition or another. You could have a high view of the sacraments. You could be a more high church person. You could be a Pentecostal. You could be a non-Pentecostal, low church. I believe, I hope that we could come together around this is what gospel renewal looks like. It's a unifying thing to say that's it. We have to do that gospel renewal. And at the same time, it enables us to carry it out within our traditions. Now, I'd like to go to a second element in what I'm calling the gospel DNA. And that is, an intentional, well-thought-out understanding of how your church is relating to the surrounding culture. Church and culture. This isn't the kind of thing that evangelicals tend to talk much about. But you need to. My denomination, if I may be so bold, the Presbyterian Church in America, is committed to the Westminster Confession. Now, I don't know if any of you here in England have heard of the Westminster Confession. It's a little thing that some of the Scots and the Americans, subscribe to. Westminster Confession is the longest doctrinal statement of faith that anybody has in the history of the world. It's enormously long. It's astounding that there are these churches like the Peace Presbyterian churches that insist that all of their officers and all their ministers subscribe to it. Do you realize how long it is? You know, there's two kinds of Presbyterian ministers. There's the ones who, say they've read the entire Westminster Confession, they believe it all, and then there's those who tell the truth. That they're sure it's true, but they really haven't read it. I don't know who has, actually. And yet, our denomination is riven with major party strife. In spite of the fact we all believe in inerrancy, we're all five-point Calvinists, we all believe the Westminster Confession with very, very, very minor deviations. Why? And the reason why is because the confession itself does not actually address the issues of how do Christians and how does the church relate to the culture. Who said Europeans aren't entrepreneurial? Yeah, all right. So, okay. Americans have this terrible stereotype of Europeans that everything takes 2 years. To anything new, 2 years of studying. Okay. Thank you. I was saying that was wrong of us Americans to have that stereotype. I wasn't saying it was right. It was a horrible racial stereotype. Forgive me, you know. Now, I'd like to make explicit some things that that usually don't get talked about and yet are the basis for a lot of disunity. And I actually think that a church planter actually has to think out, and the networks have to think out, what is the relationship of our Christian churches to the surrounding culture? And the more cultures become non-Christian or anti-Christian, the greater this issue. And people are going to make decisions, and unless you guide them theologically, unless you guide them pastorally, they're going to make decisions and they're going to create disunity inside your movement or inside your church. So I would like to give you some ideas of a relationship between Christ and culture, or the Christianity and culture, the church and culture, that I hope would be one that more and more people would see as part of gospel DNA of urban churches.
I know this, the real problem, of course, is I'm an American. I'm speaking to people in Britain. Nevertheless, I think what I'm about to tell you has a fair amount of transferability. In America, evangelicals have divided into four basic parties on this question of how does the church relate to the culture. From what I can tell, three of these four parties are here, too. One of them isn't very strong, but I'm going to lay them out because they're all possible positions, and I'm going to try to show you that every one of them is inadequate. And I'm going to give them names, and, you know, I've struggled with this because there's almost no way to give names to parties without somebody in that party taking offense at the name. So please just, I don't mean any offense. I got to find some kind of shorthand. The first group, which is maybe the default mode of the evangelical world, is what I'll call the pietist approach to culture. And the pietist approach to culture basically says that this world is temporary. Eventually, it's all going to burn up. All that really matters is souls being saved. That's the one thing that's going to last. And therefore, there's no particular reason why the Christian church ought to think that much about the society or culture around. It's our job to evangelize, disciple, win souls, bring them to Christ, period. And if we do enough evangelism, it might have an impact on society and the way things happen in society. If we do enough evangelism, enough Christians, it'll have an impact. But if that's the case, it'll basically the only way that the church influences culture is through evangelism, in which case the culture would be changed one soul at a time. That's the pietist approach. Secondly, is what I'm going to call the conservative activist approach. Now, this is not an approach that's very big in the UK or Europe, and it could be because there needs to be more of a critical mass than you have of evangelical Christians. But the conservative activist approach, at least in America and other places, is an approach that goes like this. Christians say the real problem in our culture is secularism and the loss of absolute truth. And the problem is the church has lost its conviction about truth. And what we need to do as Christians about the culture is this. We need to give Christians again a Christian worldview, show them how everything in life has to be affected by their Christian worldview. And then we need to push young people especially out into the culture, out into the media, out into Hollywood, out into the government especially, out into politics. And we need to get Christians in positions of cultural leadership, working out of a Christian worldview, and take back the culture. And that's also called, to some degree, some people would call that the Christian right. I think the Christian right is, I think what I'm talking about is a little bit broader than that. It's a lot of people who get a lot of energy around, in America, social activism around single issues like abortion, same-sex marriage, fatherhood, abstinence education, and so forth. It's this enormous empire of various sorts of initiatives and ministries and programs and foundations that are committed to this conservative activist approach, which is to say we have got to get Christians in positions of power, working out of a Christian worldview, to take back the culture. So there's the pietist approach, there's the activist approach. The third approach I'm going to call evangelical relevance, R-E-L-E-V-A-N-T-S. Who are the relevants? Well, the relevants are people who don't like the activists or the pietists. And they say, our problem is not that the Christians have lost truth. The real problem is that Christians are in their ghetto. Christians are not really engaged in people's lives. Christians are perceived as being very condemning. Christians speak in an undecipherable, to most people, language. And what Christians need, what the church needs to do to really have an impact on the culture, is it needs to get involved in the needs of people. It needs to start meeting the needs of people in the neighborhood and in the city. It needs to contextualize its message, really contextualize the vocabulary and change the way in which we talk so that it connects to where people are. So all the emphasis is almost the opposite. The activists say our problem is the church has become too much like the world. And we've all become relativists, and we need to get out there and build a culture that's based on moral absolutes. Whereas inside, I mean, the relevants are saying it's almost the opposite. We need to get out there and be more engaged in people's lives. We need to be more involved in the world. We need to be more involved in the arts and more involved in the culture and more involved in meeting the needs of people. We need to contextualize, so it's really connecting with unchurched people. And that's the relevance. Now, there's a fourth group. And the fourth group, I'm going to call the counterculturalist. They're really neo-Anabaptists. And the fourth group says that the worst thing you can possibly do is to try to change the culture. The neo-Anabaptists say that that's the Christendom mistake. The Christendom mistake, that both the relevance and the activists are wrong in trying to change the culture. Because if the church tries to change the world, what always happens is the world ends up influencing the church. If the church tries to change the church becomes like the world. Why? Because if you're like the activists trying to get your people into power, you just become one more power play and you become assimilated into the power structures of the world. Or if you're like the relevance and you're trying to meet people's felt needs, then you become one more consumeristic mall of services and you're no longer the church. And so what the counterculturalists, the neo-Anabaptists say, is you shouldn't even be trying to affect the society. They also don't like the pietists because they believe, neo-Anabaptists believe, that the church needs to follow Christ outside the gate, form thick countercultures that basically show a very, very different way of human beings living with one another and identify with the poor and the marginal and not even try to change the culture in any way. But we're just a sign of the future kingdom and that's that. We don't worry about engaging the culture. We don't try to do that. And these four, by the way, in America at least, a lot of younger leaders are split between the third and the fourth approach, the neo-Anabaptist approach and the relevant approach. They're very turned off by both the pietist and the activist approach. Now, these groups, and I know to some degree these same stress fractures are happening in the UK because these groups have representatives here. Not so much the second group, I know, but they do. These groups are clashing. And basically, by reading certain books, you may very often find that your folks that you have gathered to start to, and you're trying to do church plant, you'll very often sometimes find that there's a level of disunity that happens at a certain level. That people are reading various books. You're not addressing it as a church planter. You're not addressing Christ and culture. You don't feel like that's your job, in which case you're probably a pietist without maybe knowing it. But other people, especially your younger people, are really interested in all this stuff. And they're reading these things. And so then it creates a certain amount of disunity inside your own church because you're not actually setting a direction for them. Now, these groups are actually clashing with each other. And at one level, the question is, why? Let's think for a minute about those four groups. And what each one says is the main problem or the main thing the church ought to be doing about society. Couldn't we agree with all of them? For example, isn't it true that one of the reasons why the church is so anemic in its impact on society and one of the reasons that Christian values don't have an impact on society is simply because we're evangelistically so ineffective? Isn't that true? You know, Mark Knoll, a great Christian, he's a historian of American history mainly. Mark Knoll has said that probably the height of influence of evangelical Christianity on American culture was probably in the 1830s. That was the height. And it was because of the awakenings. It was because of the enormous amount of church growth that had happened. And the awakenings had led to such church growth that maybe Mark Knoll thought that perhaps close to 50% maybe of the population were involved in evangelical churches or ministries. And it was so, isn't it true that one of the reasons why we don't have the impact is we're evangelistically ineffective? Yes. But secondly, isn't it true that Christians actually are no longer really represented in any kind of major way in the various factors of our cultural economy? What do I mean by cultural economy? Well, James Hunter, my friend James Hunter, who's a sociologist, made a little list. He says there's the visual arts, literature and poetry, theater and dance, academic philosophy, legal philosophy, academic think tanks, major research universities, leading opinion magazines and journals, high-end journalism, most of the major foundations, what we would call your charitable trusts, public television, film and high-end advertising agency, there's a little list. How many Christians are in those things? How many recognizably Christian voices are in those things? And even when you know that there are individual Christians in those areas, they're exactly that. They're individuals. They're not working in dense networks. And as a result, there's no impact of Christian values on your society because there's no Christians or there's no recognizable Christian voices in those places. So isn't that true too? Yes. Or thirdly, is it not true that the way in which evangelicals communicate the gospel is somewhat indecipherable to the average person? The average person coming in off the street, listening to a sermon, is it not true that they would find it very difficult? Is it not true that Christians are not known as being unbelievably committed to the common good of their neighborhoods and their cities? Isn't that true? Yes, it's true. And lastly, is it not true what the Neo-Anabaptists say, and that is to a great degree, the church is failing to be different than the rest of society? I mean, you know, the joke, almost it's a joke in America, is if you're an evangelical, you don't drink alcohol, but you're as individualistic, consumeristic, materialistic, and caught up in power pursuits as everybody else. You don't look, you know. Isn't it true, therefore, that the church is failing to be the church? And that's one of the reasons why there's no impact. Yes. So everybody's right. They're all right. And if they're all right, why are they fighting? And they are, by the way. They're like tectonic plates. In our, by the way, for example, in our recent election, the first two groups voted Republican, the last two groups, by and large, voted Democrat. And they're very, very, very put out with each other as a result. And I put out is putting it really mildly. They're looking at each other like, are you really in the same religion with me? And I think you're going to find increasingly, as you find, in some ways, European society has been secular longer than American society. But on the other hand, it's been traditional. It's been more traditional. So those of you who've been back and forth know what I'm talking about. It's been more secular. At the same time, there's a certain traditionalism about European society, about gender roles, about authority. In some ways, though you're more secular than America has been, in some ways you've been almost more traditional, but that's starting to go away. And increasingly, you're going to find real hostility to being a Christian, and then you're going to start having the same problems that we have in America, which is to say, how do we relate to the society that seems to be becoming more and more anti-Christian and non-Christian? These groups don't like each other, in spite of the fact that on the surface they look like they're all true, they're all right. But if you look a little more deeply, they are unbalanced. They've got a very important seminal insight, and if you actually look at it sort of at the top level, they're all right. But the fact is that they really cannot stand one another. So, for example, pietists and conservative activists are deeply, deeply suspicious of the emphasis on justice and caring for the poor in the other groups. The relevance and the Neo-Anabaptists are extremely unhappy with the kind of cultural conservatism rather than biblical morality. Very often there's a kind of cultural conservatism that goes along with the conservative activists and the pietists. Another big problem, by the way, is that we live in a society, do we not, that says if you're a Christian, fine, but you keep it private. That is for the private life. Okay? And pietists and Neo-Anabaptists are actually, maybe they don't see it this way, they're actually doing what the dominant culture tells them to do. They're keeping it private. Even in spite of the fact I don't think that's what the Bible tells us to do. On the other hand, you find very often the conservative activists are, in many cases, putting evangelism and ministry behind the importance of power. The conservative activists have not got a lot to show for themselves in America over the last 20 years. They're in a great deal of disarray because they have not been able to get their agenda through, and they're beginning to question their whole agenda because they haven't really made much of an impact on the culture for all this emphasis on getting our people into places of power. Don Carson has a book that came out this year called Christ and Culture Revisited. And even though it's, in many ways, it's not a, it's a great book. I suggest you read it. And it lays the groundwork for what I'm going to say here. It doesn't actually say what I'm going to say in here in the next 15 minutes. But it lays the groundwork for it because what he essentially says is that if you understand the biblical storyline as being creation, fall, redemption, and restoration, that is the biblical storyline from Genesis to Revelation. Creation, fall, redemption, restoration. Every one of these positions of Christ and culture is strong on one and weak on others. So he would say, for example, the pietist approach that puts the emphasis on evangelism is really big on redemption, but frankly is weak on its doctrine of creation. Because the doctrine of creation is that this world is good and that God made it good. And God looked at it and continually said, this is good, this is good. That's what Genesis 1 is all about. And he put human beings into the garden to take care of his material creation. And Psalm 104, verse 30 says that the Holy Spirit waters the face of the earth. That God takes delight in taking care of the material creation. And so pietists, by saying what really matters is evangelism, and really doesn't matter. You know, if you're out there working, you're not really doing anything, just tithe to us people who are missionaries, because that's we're doing God's work. And so what Don is saying is, well, you know what? They're weak on creation. They're strong on redemption. The relevant types who put all this emphasis on we've got to adapt to the culture, we've really got to become people like the culture in a sense, we've got to contextualize the culture. Don would say that they're weak on the doctrine of sin and they understand sin in rather superficial ways. They see sin as disobeying rules in a behavioral way, but they miss the idolatries and the ways in which every culture, postmodern, modern, pre-modern, every culture is so filled with idolatry and filled with sin, and therefore they tend to be naive and they overadapt. So there's a whole lot of reasons why none of these positions are adequate. So what should we do? I'd like to give you four planks in about 10 minutes, that if you keep these four planks in balance. Now, they're in the handout, only they're in much longer form than I'm about to give them to you. And the four planks, which I think if you keep in balance, keeps you from being in any one of these parties and would, I think, be a way forward. I don't want to come up with a name for what this is because I don't like names. I don't like categories. But here's what these four things are. The first one has to do with what I'll call light. Gracious, radical service. And I'm getting the idea of light from the place where Jesus says, you are the light of the world. And then inside the light metaphor says, you're a city on the hill. Now, I don't have time to do close exegesis of this text. But when Jesus says in Matthew 5 there, when he says, first of all, you're salt of the earth, I'll get to that. Then he says, you're the light of the world. Your good deeds are going to glorify God, so the pagans, the Gentiles, will praise God. And in the middle of the light metaphor, he says, you're a city on a hill. And I'm convinced by the commentators who say that the city metaphor and the light metaphor go together. In fact, I think R.T. France actually says, you know, the idea seems if you were out in the desert and you came upon a city and a hill at night, there would be this, you'd see these lights from afar. And here's what I believe that this means. The first plank, and this is where I'm different than the pietists and the conservative activists. The first plank in having an impact on our culture is that we have to be a community, a city. To be a city, you've got to be a community. A city that is known for good deeds, or to be Augustinian about it, we're a city of light inside the city of man. We're the city of God inside the city of man. And the citizens of the city of God need to be the very best citizens of the city of man. It means that In New York City, I would love it if there were enough Christians living so sacrificially for their neighbors, so sacrificially for the people around them, that it became well known that this was true, that secularism tends to make people individualistic and selfish, and religiosity tends to make people tribal and self-righteous. But gospel Christianity, on the basis of truth, turns people outward to meet the needs of their neighbor and to love people who don't believe as they do. Secularism makes people selfish and individualistic. Religiosity tends to make people tribal and self-righteous, but the gospel turns people into those who love their neighbor. I always say to our churches in New York City, I say, your neighbors should know that though they don't all agree with you and don't believe what you believe, that you are trying to make that neighborhood a better place to live, and that you want to do that for everybody around, whether they believe like you do or not. That's going to have an enormous evangelistic impact on in the long run. But in the short run, what you're basically saying to your neighbors is, how do we press value into the neighborhood? How do we make this place a far better place for all of you to live because we're here? How do we become the kind of church that the neighbors around the church say, well, I don't agree with all that they teach, you know, I don't believe what they believe, but I would shudder to imagine what this area of the city would be like if they weren't here. See, that's what it means to be light. That's what it means to have your good deeds leading the pagans to praise the Father. Okay, so that's light. That's the first thing, and that's not like the Pietists and the culture and the conservative actors. But secondly, salt. Now, the salt image, again, I can't do the exegesis. I love this salt image. You're salt of the earth. I agree with the commentators who believe that salt here is a preservative, basically. And what I love about the salt metaphor, when it talks about our relationship with the world, is, first of all, salt is a modest metaphor. You see, the conservative activists like to talk about taking back the culture and transforming the culture and redeeming the culture. But salt is basically just keeps the meat from going bad. I mean, you know, salt doesn't cook the meat. You put salt in the meat, it doesn't cook it. It just keeps it cookable for a longer time. And I actually believe that salt, on the one hand, is very modest. It's really saying to be salt in society means that Christians are in society and keeping from society from being anywhere near as bad as it could be. It means that Christians are, however, distributed. That's the other thing I like about the metaphor. It's a modest metaphor, but at the same time, unlike the Neo-Anabaptists, it's saying that Christians are supposed to be getting out into the society. We are supposed to be in all of those parts of the cultural economy, in the arts. We are supposed to be in the think tanks. We are supposed to be in politics. We're supposed to be everywhere, living out of a Christian worldview. But now see, light and salt, think about this. Taking back the culture means we're going to take over. If Christians are known for loving people and caring about the common good, that they're after love more than they're after power, that will bring us the kind of power that is merited. I mentioned before, I was reading recently a book about the fact that when Christians were a minority in the Roman Empire, because the bishops were so committed to the poor, people let the bishops speak for the whole community because they felt like they represented the whole community because they were so... because they were committed to the marginalized, they weren't marginalized. And if you ignore the marginalized, you will be marginalized. So... If there's gracious radical service, which is light, then when Christians as salt spread out into the world, and they do need to be in the world, they do need to be making it their job, and it's the churches should be saying to its people, be artists, think out what it means to be a Christian in the art world, and be as prolific an artist as you possibly can be. People in those venues, people in those places need to know that their church is behind them. And if the church is only saying, well, you know, what it means to do, you know, the Lord's work is we just evangelize and disciple. And if you're out there being an artist or a businessman, fine, just please tithe to us because we're doing the Lord's work and it'll help us do it. But salt means, no, we are pushing. We are pressing people out there. And I can say more about that if you ask me a question or two, because we only have so much time here. So first of all, you have light. Secondly, you have salt. Or as James Hunter, my friend James Hunter, I'm borrowing a term from him, faithful cultural presence. That's what I mean by salt. Faithful cultural presence means commitment to the truth and being present in the culture, not absent like the New Anabaptists or the Pietists, not triumphalistic like the conservative activists. But we need to be a movement of churches that's constantly talking to the non-missionaries and the non-evangelists and the non-pastors and preachers and saying to the 99% of everybody else, we want you to be salt, and we're going to try to equip you to be salt. Okay, so light, salt. Now, third, church and church. The third plank in a cultural strategy here, a cultural relationship strategy, is church and church. What do I mean by that? Some of you, you know, have no idea. You know, in the presence of so many people from Holland, I shudder to say this, but I believe that Abraham Kuyper has something to teach us all. Kuyper, on the one hand, believed in what he, now this is my English version of it, and I have no idea whether this is a good translation of whatever terms he used, I have no idea. But Kuyper believed in what he called the institutional church and the organic church. That's how it's come across in English, by the way, everybody. The institutional church is the church qua church. It's the church organized under its officers, under its elders. It's the church organized to gather in worship. It's the church organized to preach the word, administer discipline, administer the sacraments, and so forth. By the organic church, he means Christians uniting to deal with sex trafficking. Christians in the arts uniting to think out how are we going to make a difference in the art world. How are we going to help each other move forward? Christians uniting to deal with poverty in a particular area, or to reform prisons, or to deal with immigration policy. The organic church is a church. Now, you might say that's parachurch, or those are foundations or voluntary societies. Well, yes, but Kuyper said that's still part of the church. That's Christians uniting to bring Christian understandings of justice and mercy to bear on society. The institutional church's job is to basically evangelize and disciple. Now, that doesn't mean that the institutional church doesn't help the needy. I heard Richard, I was very happy when Richard said, we need to have a better understanding of the diaconate. Ask me about this and I'll tell you, that's been crucial to Redeemer's success in the city. And that is a body of men and women, deacon and deaconesses, who press hundreds of thousands of dollars a year into the economic and practical needs of people in the church and right around the church. Nevertheless, if you're going to actually make a difference in the whole city, if you're going to try to make a major difference, if for example, there's a new immigrant community that's very poor and you want the church to make an impact on them, then the best thing to do is to have a mission or to have an organization, a voluntary society, a charitable society that gets together of Christians to say, we're going to reach out. We're going to do evangelism there, or we're going to do mercy ministry, or we're going to try to work for social reform in that area. That's the church, and that's the church. Now, here's what's important. One of the dangers of not understanding this distinction is you can have the problem that happened to the mainline church in America and perhaps established churches here. And that is the social ministry and the social activism can squeeze out the importance of preaching the word and evangelizing. But if you understand the difference of church and church, institutional church and organic church, that it's not the institutional church's job, for example, it's the institutional church's job to disciple Christians, to be thoughtful Christian filmmakers, and to have their Christianity affect their filmmaking. But it is not the job, I don't believe, and Kuyper certainly would say this, of that local church to set up a film production company. That's the organic church. And once you understand that, then when you say, what is the mission of the church? Is it to preach the gospel, or is it to feed the hungry, or to affect society? Well, the answer is yes. And yet you can still say the mission of the institutional church is mainly to make disciples. Yet the mission of the church, institutional and organic, is to do all the things that God commands us to do as Christians, including loving thy neighbor, you know, the Good Samaritan, etc. Lastly, and I'll just say this brief. I said there's light, there's salt, there's church and church. Okay. It's, you know, being sensitive to the distinction between institutional and organic church. Lastly, I've already alluded to this. The church needs to disciple people for their public life, not just their private life. As a minister, I was, a quick story is, early on at Redeemer, we saw some actors become Christians, and these were actors on Broadway, on television, and when they became Christians, they came to me and they said, we got some problems. And I remember one guy came and said to me, one of my problems I have is that I need to know what roles I can take and what roles can I take. I mean, is it all, what kind of stories, as a Christian actor, is it all right for me to tell, and what stories can I tell? I hadn't a clue. He asked me, he gave me some examples. I didn't know what to say. And then at one point he actually says, and what do you think about method acting? I said, what do you mean about method acting? He said, well, this is an American, especially American model. Method acting is you don't act angry, you get angry. You remember something in your past that made you angry, and you get angry. So you don't just act angry, or you don't just act lustful. You don't just act anxious. You get anxious. You get lustful. You get angry. What do you think of that as an acting method? And I remember saying, well, that sounds bad, I think. But you see, what I realized after that interview was that I knew how to disciple people to be Christians on the weekends and in the evenings, but I had no idea how to disciple them to be Christians all during the day when they were at work. I knew how to disciple them in a way that brought them out of their life, out of their work, into more and more into the church. That's the only way I knew how to disciple people, to bring them more and more out of the world into the church. I had no idea how to actually help people think Christianly about their work. Michael Lindsay wrote a book called Faith in the Halls of Power, in which he interviewed in America 450 people who were pretty high up in business and in the arts and in Hollywood and in government. And these were evangelical Christians. He found that 2/3 of them hardly went to church. And the reason was, they said, that when I have a job, I mean, one guy was like the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, and he says, I really believe that by being a Christian in this place, not just by my philanthropy, but by the way in which I'm running my company, you know, I'm being salt and light. But the fact is, I can't be an elder, I can't be a deacon, I can't be I don't have time to lead a Bible study in my home. In fact, I don't even have time to be every week in a Bible study. And so most people look at me as if I'm just not very committed to the church. And he says, I just cannot tell you how unsupported by the church I have felt. I've got no training for doing my job. I get no recognition for it. In fact, I'm just looked upon askance because why aren't you more active in our church? And it would be a rare movement of churches. In fact, I don't know of a movement of churches that really knows how to disciple people and celebrate being salt, being out there. We don't know how to do that. We don't do that. Or if there are churches that do that, they're not evangelistic. I want to do it all. We must do it all. We can't fall into one of these categories. And then last, if we do this in cities, if we're light and salt, if we are sensitive to the distinction between the institutional church and the organic church, if we disciple people for thinking out how Christianity shapes the way in which they work, and we elevate that and celebrate that and push them out there and disciple them for it, if you do it in cities, it will change society. Because as cities go, and as the people who live in cities are disproportionately important to how culture goes. And if we have church movements like that in cities, it will have an impact on culture. So there's some ideas on the Christ culture model. And I imagine that this is so utterly different than the first talk on, you know, evangelism, you know, renewal and revival, that some of you are saying, what? But I believe that both of having a deep understanding of both of these areas, gospel renewal and the relationship of church to culture, is crucial for being successful as church planters in cities. More so than out in the rural areas. Much more so. Okay.